Today is June 21st, 2023. We have three cases on our oral calendar today. This is the first, A22-1678. Is it L. Alfredi versus City of St. Paul? Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant. The podium you can adjust up and down. There's a button underneath, and also you can adjust the microphone. When you begin your argument, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Benjamin Letcher, and I represent the appellants, Ali Alfredi, Maryland Supermarket, Inc., and Maryland Tobacco, Inc., in this matter. This case is about the appellant's efforts to continue operating as they've always operated, including by operating a tobacco shop permitted to sell all tobacco products which the City of St. Paul permits to be sold in its borders. Alfredi purchased the, and I'll be brief on the facts, but just to get oriented, he purchased the supermarket business in 2011 before purchasing the property containing the business as well as a separate storefront containing a restaurant in 2015. The city passed ordinances which allowed the sale of tobacco products, which may be sold in the city only at tobacco product shops. That's a term of art, and that happened in 2018. And so appellants applied for and received a license after paying more than $10,000 to satisfy conditions required by the city to modify the store to essentially separate the tobacco shop from the rest of the store. In 2020, the city claimed to have discovered that the license was not properly granted because the property, which was zoned B1, pursuant to those ordinance changes, no longer allowed a tobacco shop. Initially, Alfredi sought to rezone the property to T2 and had the support of city staff, zoning committee, planning commission, but was stymied with the city council when in 2021 that application was denied. So appellants sued. We have a three-count declaratory judgment action, challenging that the property, the rezoning application should have been approved and that there was no rational basis to deny it. Two, that even if the application was properly denied, the use should be allowed to continue as a non-conforming use. And then three, an equitable estoppel claim. Those last two claims, counts two and three, were dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. The court issued a protective order limiting the record as to count one, and then ultimately granted summary judgment as to count one. And I just want to focus on some of the main issues in the briefs. With respect to count one.
Could I ask you a question at the outset?
Yeah.
If the city did make a mistake in issuing the permit, do you agree that they could correct the mistake?
That's what the case law says, that if they legitimately made a mistake, and setting aside the equitable estoppel claim and the non-conforming use claim, yes, they could. So that would could defeat count one. I do believe that there, if we were allowed discovery, facts would be developed that it wasn't a dispute. You know, I wasn't allowed to present anything, but it's...
Well, to that point, counsel, and I want to focus on the third count of with respect to the B1 zone.
Yeah.
What is the specific disputed material fact relating to B1 zoning?
Well, I guess there's kind of two different kinds. I would say there's three disputes. One is a legal dispute, and then if I'm understanding the court correctly, I would say there are two categories of factual disputes at issue. One is whether there was a sufficient legal reason that, and maybe I'm not understanding the court properly, a sufficient legal reason given for denying the rezoning application?
Yeah, and just to clarify, maybe to put in a little bit more context, so this is granted on summary judgment, correct? And so in order to overcome summary judgment, I understood your argument to be that there, in addition to whether or not the city provided factual support for its decision, that you're also arguing that there was a dispute of material fact which made summary judgment inappropriate.
Right. So the material dispute of fact is as to some of the three proffered reasons that the reason was even given. So like the first reason that the property doesn't fit the definition of T2 zoning. I think there's a legitimate and material dispute of fact that the city gave that as a reason, because the law requires that not only do they give a legally sufficient writing and put it in writing at the time of the hearing, but then that it be supported. And I get it that as to, it's a unique burden on the appellants in this kind of case, because as to the whether there's sufficient evidence in the record to support the reason, the case law says, well, if reasonable minds can differ, then the city wins. Right, so in a summary judgment context, where reasonable minds differ, that precludes summary judgment. That wouldn't necessarily operate, and almost never would operate that way as to that issue. But as to the first issue of whether the reason was actually given, I think you have a more traditional summary judgment approach. Did the city present the issue at the hearing, and then in a contemporaneous manner memorialize it? We have a long time delay of about 6 weeks between the hearing, or intermediate hearings between when the hearing took place, where the ordinance was denied, and when the memorialization occurred. But also, if you compare what was said at the hearing, it's very heavy on impermissible considerations.
Right, but there only has to be one reason, one legitimate reason, to affirm what the city's decision. And the city council did conclude during the hearing that the current B1 zoning does not need changing to accommodate business changes on the site. Why isn't that sufficient to support the city council's decision with respect to the B1 zoning?
I would say, well, it can't be a conclusory determination. I would say that that's a conclusory determination, and the evidence which the city then sought to use to support the determination that B2 zoning is fine are false representations about the comp plan and the small area plan, the representation that the comp plan says it's to be left as B1s. We have a conclusory statement. B1 is fine. Reason why B1 is fine, because the comp plan says to leave it as is, and the small area plan says to leave it as is. And those were representations made by the council president to the rest of the council, when in fact those are demonstrably false.
Well, but the city council also stated that the B1 zoning was consistent with the way that the area is developing, and that there's still a small grocery store within the property which fits within the intent of B1 zoning. That seems fairly specific to the facts here, rather than just a conclusory statement.
I guess what I would say to that is that we really have to be focused on the decision that's being made here, and the decision is to deny the request to switch to T2 zoning. And you have to have a legally sufficient reason, and when you're looking at it, and this is the St. Croix development case that we've cited, and that's 446 Northwest 2nd, 392, you're not looking at the particular use of the property. You're looking at the property as a whole and whether the zoning classification fits the property as a whole.
Right, and we start with the presumption, that the original zoning classification of the property is well planned and is expected to remain somewhat permanent. And that's from the Frenshaw versus City of Blaine case.
And my response to that, and I know I briefed it as well, is that that Frenshaw, and I'm probably, no, if I'm mispronouncing it either, that is citing the Sun Oil. And Sun Oil, that presumption, is citing to a Maryland case. And Sun Oil and Frenshaw are both cases where the zoning classification at issue that was existing prior to the application was established in a comprehensive plan. So when the existing zoning classification is established as part of a comprehensive plan, so if the city wants to say, here's how we're going to set up the whole city, and we're doing this, we're not looking at individual properties and treating one person one way and one person another way. We're going to set up the whole city as part of a huge plan. And if a zoning class for a property gets set up as part of that plan, it gets that presumption. And that's what, oh, I thought, and that's why when it gets that presumption, you have the difficulty where you have to show that that original zoning classification is irrational, and essentially amounts to a taking, or that circumstances have changed such that while it may not have been irrational when it was made, now it affects a taking.
Were you able to find any cases that would support that restrictive interpretation of those that applies only in the when there's a underlying comprehensive plan?
I cannot find any case, Sun Oil, Frenshaw, all the cases that use that interpretation involve a case where the existing zoning classification is set forth in the comprehensive plan. I didn't locate any others, so I read all those cases to mean that, and the way that I come to that conclusion is that if you assume that every zoning classification, whether it's pursuant to an individual ordinance or pursuant to a comp plan, has that presumption, and that the plaintiff must show that the existing classification is irrational in order to get the new zoning, then every plaintiff necessarily has to show a taking in order to get rezoning. Because that's what the showing of a taking is to show that there's no reasonable use of the property under the zoning classification. And that's not the law. So the only way to square the cases that I see is, and starting with Sun Oil and moving forward to everyone who relies on Sun Oil, is that that presumption only applies, and I think I'm restating myself now, in that one circumstance. So that's what came up at the summary judgment hearing, and that's what I briefed probably too extensively or with the district court or overstated things, but that's my position on that.
And what's the language in Sun Oil that would support that specific view of the case?
So Sun Oil, and this is 220 Northwest 2nd, 256. And this is at 262. We are compelled to regard the Village Council's action in furtherance of its comprehensive zoning ordinance as a reasonable legislative determination, not subject to judicial interference. So the holding in Sun Oil is that because the zoning classification was made as part of a comp plan, that's all the city has to say. We want to follow our comp plan. We already made a legislative determination. It's the comp plan. We follow our previous legislative determination. That's a rational basis because we already made that determination. And it's like the corollary is when you have your CUP, you're going to apply for a conditional use permit. There's already an ordinance that says you need to check these 8 boxes. If you check these 8 boxes and present evidence on those 8 boxes, we've already legislatively determined you get your CUP. And so it's an abuse for a council to deny a CUP acting in a quasi-judicial manner when the person has satisfied those boxes that have already been legislatively determined to be appropriate. Similarly, with the comp plan, they've already legislatively determined as part of an overarching scheme that something is appropriate, and so that is permitted the deference. But, and I cited the case law too, but it's,
But the district court did state, though, that the city council stated that its 2040 comprehensive plan did not contemplate changes to B1 zoning in the area, and that B1 zoning was consistent with how the area was developing. So the district court seemed to agree with the city council. So why is the district court's decision erroneous on that point?
Well, the comp plan, and I see I have about 45 seconds, so I'll try to be quick, but the comp plan doesn't designate any property within the city by zoning class. It designates them in broad categories such as, in this case, urban neighborhood. And yes, there could be multiple classifications that would fit urban neighborhood. But I guess my point is, if a proponent of a zoning application shows that their property, and I don't think that any reasonable person could say that, and the city is almost basically conceding it at this point, that the property fits a T2, and that's what the staff and everyone else believe. And I see I'm out of time.
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Council.
Thank you.
Council for respondent, you will have 15 minutes as well. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kyle Sitta on behalf of the respondent, the City of St. Paul, in this matter. I apologize. My infant was up all night, so if I yawn, it is not because this is boring. I'm just a little sleep deprived today. This case, I always like to do some kind of narrative in an oral argument. I actually struggled to come up with a narrative for this one, only because I think this case is relatively straightforward. I think counsel on both sides have briefed this fairly well. And to me, the case is fairly simple. Mr. Alfaridi would like a tobacco license to sell certain tobacco products on his property. He has the wrong zone. So he's tried a variety of different ways to make it possible. And so we are here with, I think, extensive briefing on a multitude of issues, just because we're seeing all these stabs at how can I get this license to stick on my property. And at the end of the day, I think the way to do this, and we've, you know, I'll focus here on the non-conforming use estoppel claims for just a moment. Those two claims, I think, are claims that need to be sandwiched into his administrative case. He can raise those there. He can argue those to the ALJ, and that would go up on jurisdictional certiorari to this court eventually. And when it comes to the zoning claim, I think it's important to, again, emphasize the standards of review that we were just talking about, which is it is a difficult burden because it's a legislative burden. A zoning classification is not a kind of quasi-judicial decision. It's considered a legislative decision by our council. It's, you know, this is not the most perfect analogy, but it's like the city council's passing its version of a policy debate from Congress or something like that. It is deciding how to shape the city of St. Paul itself. So it gets
you recognize the difference in thoroughness when it comes to the zoning decision versus a comprehensive plan development.
Yes, of course, Your Honor. It feels like there's a question buried in there somewhere.
Well, yeah, I'm taking you to Mr. Letcher's position about the SunOil and application of the presumption applying, being only fitting when you have a comprehensive plan, a more thorough legislative backing as opposed to a zoning decision.
No, and it's an interesting argument. I guess I just read the cases how the cases are read. I don't see any language in there that says you need some comp plan backing, and just to get theoretical, which was the Court of Appeals, let's get theoretical. In theory, the comp plan is the buttress for all zoning ordinances. You cannot have a disharmony between the City of St. Paul's comp plan and its zoning ordinances. There is case law that says if you do, the City of St. Paul is required to bring its zoning ordinances into compliance with its comp plan. In essence, and what I like to say internally at the City of St. Paul is the comp plan is sort of our supreme law of the zoning land for the City of St. Paul. So, I mean, if the issue is, well, you know, you have to have this comp plan lurking in the background via SunOil, via this Maryland case, I guess one point I would say is it already is. It has to be that way under Minnesota's Supreme Court case law. Two, I guess I don't, I don't like to read cases by squinting really hard and trying to mishmash four different cases together to, you know, solve a Rubik's Cube. I like to read a case as it's read. And when I read Freundschaft, and I would also point out the Hahn case has the exact same language from Freundschaft in it, and that to me, I don't see a comp plan discussion in that case either. It just says there is a presumption that the city is going to shape legislatively its city the way it wants to, and we will honor that presumption unless it was incorrect from the start or the area has changed so much that there's no good reason for the city to keep the zone. That to me seems perfectly reasonable as a piece of law, as a piece of logic. I guess I don't see how I'm a simple man. When I read a case, I like to just read the case and extract a holding out of it. And if I have to squint hard, I will. But I don't think it makes sense for us to squint so hard that we assemble this comp plan idea. And in fact, I just have trouble even following it. So sorry, Judge Ross, I'm long-winded explanation to your question, but I think we should read the cases as they stand, which is just that this presumption exists. And I think the logic behind the presumption makes sense to me. I hope I answered your question, Judge. And what I would say too, I understand Mr. Letcher and Mr. Alfredi are a little unhappy with, you know, this outcome. And what I would say on the zoning issue is it's not a hard issue just because look at that definition of a B1 zone. It's pretty straightforward. It says, are you in a residential neighborhood, basically box one? And box two is, does this property have the ability to serve the, I think the language is basic convenience, shopping, or service needs of people in that residential neighborhood? And we look at the record, is it a residential neighborhood? I don't think anybody disputes that. Okay, we can check that box off. So number two, does this property have the ability to serve the convenience and shopping needs of the neighborhood? I would even argue that appellant concedes that that's true. He has a grocery store. It's been there for a long time, as appellant concedes. That is... I can't twist myself into a pretzel to say that that's not a convenience or shopping need to the residential area. So to me, check, check. We have two boxes checked that we need for the B1 zone. That's the ballgame. That is all that's required. It's a legislative decision. And again, the standard is, can we have a reasonable debate about this? I think what we're doing here proves that we can. And that standard means the city should win on the rezoning decision.
When you're making that argument, though, aren't you making that toward the grocery store rather than tobacco shop?
I think so, yes. I'm sorry, Judge, not to cut you off.
Why doesn't the tobacco shop fit the B1 zoning requirements then?
I guess, so the tobacco shop, well, one, because our code says it can't. So it, for whatever reason, this hasn't been briefed, but our zoning code just happens to say if you have a B1 zone, we don't allow a tobacco product shop or we don't issue a tobacco license of any sort.
But that's new. That's something that changed.
Right.
That wasn't the original language.
That is
correct. The original tobacco shop fit the B1 zoning language.
Yes. Yes. And so it's an interesting argument. And I think that's an interesting argument toward the nonconforming use claim, which to me is a claim that needs to shoot back into the ALJ case to preserve that tobacco license. I think that's a very interesting claim. I would love to know how it turns out, but that's just not what we're here for today.
And your argument on the non-conforming use claim is if I recall from the briefing, is that there is a path, an administrative path to that, and the futility argument is an argument that's been waived. But in terms of the, and you acknowledge, well, you seem to acknowledge that the city basically said one thing and then did another.
If my supervisor was here, I'd think really hard about how to answer that question. What I would say is, I don't know that I would acknowledge that the city said X and then pulled the rug out and did Y. I think that's something that should be developed in the correct forum to understand exactly what was said, what was promised, what was insinuated, if that makes sense.
If that's the case, then why have a protective order? Why not allow the record to be developed to further clarify what exactly happened there?
Two reasons, Your Honor. The first reason is jurisdictional, because if the claim doesn't belong here, we don't have the jurisdiction to even conduct discovery on that claim. That claim needs to be in the ALJ case where it can be unearthed, discovered, and rounded out.
And the city's acknowledging that any decision in the city's favor, should we render that decision in this case, would have no preclusive effect in that administrative proceeding?
No, not at all. It's, in fact, I think this decision, I mean, from the bottom of my heart, I think that nonconforming use and estoppel claim needs to be in that ALJ case where it can be properly unearthed and discovered. And in fact, you know, the rules of evidence, as we all know, are a little more relaxed there. It would be easier to develop these claims there in the first place. I do, you know, I'm not just saying this because I'm paid to say it. I truly believe it needs to be in that ALJ claim.
I noticed you didn't directly answer Judge Reyes's question as to whether the city pulled the rug out from underneath.
Oh, sorry. Not to be evasive. I will get back to you, Judge Reyes. Whether or not it directly pulled it out, simple, maybe cop-out answer is I don't know, because that hasn't been developed. And like I said, because it's jurisdictional, and two, because the case law says you don't crack open the record at this point. We've briefed very heavily the question of when do you crack open records in administrative cases? Because what I like to describe the district court as in these kind of cases is a quasi-court of appeals, not to tarnish your reputation, but to, you know, bring up the reputation of the district court. It is functioning in a way as a review court from the city council, which is acting as a quasi-district court in these kind of cases. And if you look at that Swanson case, what it says is, you know, we are looking, and there's this paragraph kind of at the end, and I think I even shoved it in the end of my brief that you can all go back and read. But it basically says, look, if a city is doing everything it can to create a full and fair record, it doesn't make sense for us to say, let's just do it all over again in district court. The point is, if it's fair and clear and complete record, you close the record down. You basically get your shot in district court. If you don't take your shot, I'm sorry. The only way to crack it open, from my reading of case law, is to say, well, there was an actual emergency, excuse me, there was some kind of problem, there was a piece of evidence I should have had at the time that I didn't know about that came, it was, you know, hidden from me, there is some kind of emergency, and even then, you crack the record open just a bit to shove that piece of new evidence in, because we're not doing over the city council hearing. That is your chance to say your piece, to get what you want. So, Judge Reyes, what I would say is there is no harm. It just needs to be done in the right way.
So if I'm understanding your argument, what you're saying is the opportunity, the due process is in the city council proceeding itself, when you can present evidence, when you can make your arguments, when the record is open. So it's more, that's more akin to the district court for us, and the district court is acting more in more or less our role when it's reviewing the record. It's just limited to the record that is presented before it. Whereas, you know, similarly here, we don't open up the record. It's just limited to what has been decided below.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
And what's the basis for that again?
The case
you
law.
Said Swanson won. But.
Swanson is one. Swanson is kind of the progenitor case that establishes this rule. And in fact, I can always love getting the case site question right when I'm in the zone.
It's cited in your brief.
Yes, it's all cited in the brief. I mean, it's
page 33,
and it's all been fleshed out. This is one of those where it's a simple concept, but it is complex when you actually drill down into it. Because what is fair? Well, you know, as I cite in the brief, fair is a term of art, but it basically means, do you have a chance to say, present your side of the argument and offer any evidence you want? Yes, we have that in city council hearing. Is it clear and complete? What does that mean? Again, another term of art that has multiple prongs, because we're the law. We love to have subsets upon subsets, but basically it means, do you have an accurate transcript? It doesn't even have to be verbatim. Well, it's a verbatim transcript in our case. You can actually look at the video feed and look at facial expressions. It is more than an accurate transcript. And besides being accurate, I always miss this last prong. Were the findings made on the record, and which, again, you know, whether or not Mr. Alfaridi does not like the findings on the record is not at issue on that particular prong. It is whether or not the city made findings on the record, which I think even Mr. Alfaridi agrees they did. Whether or not he accepts those is a matter entirely. So what I would say is the case law is what closes the record here. Because it's an administrative case, because this is a quasi-legislative decision, the record remains closed unless there's a good reason to crack it open. And even then, like I said, it's a narrow crack open to shove something in that you had at the time that you didn't, for a good reason, have the ability to introduce. If there's nothing further, I have no other comments for the panel.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Just briefly, since Judge Ross had asked about a case of, and my interpretation of Sun Oil and all the cases after it and the mention of Hahn, the quotation in Hahn to Sun Oil comes in Section 3. It's all dicta, and all it says is it's already, the court's already made its determination to send it back to the trial court, and it's talking prospectively about what might happen back in the trial court, and then it just quotes, not as part of the holding at all, also the original classification of this property as a single-family residential is presumed to be well-planned and intended to be more or less permanent, and it says, see Sun Oil, quoting that Maryland case. And that's it. So if you look at what Sun Oil was actually holding and all the cases that relied on Sun Oil to actually make a holding, I see that consistency, and I can't find any inconsistency or any other way to square the cases. But as to the point the question that I was answering before I stopped, so from my perspective, we put in an application, my client does, to switch to T2. The city has to have at least one legally permissible reason supported by sufficient evidence that's rational for that. And we're looking at the entire zoning classification, not drilling down on a particular use that's permitted. And I don't think that it's fair to state or that even reasonable minds can differ that the city council was legitimately weighing between B1 and T2 and declared B1 the winner. But even if it did and it said we declare B1 the winner because we want to preserve a residential feel, that's about as extensive of a declaration that there is. B1 zoning allows almost zero residential uses. T2 zoning allows all of those lower density residential uses. It's the zoning classification, and if you look, and it's in the summary judgment record, you know, I just picked the three closest recent rezoning applications that switched to T2 near my client, and the council is routinely allowing rezoning to T2 in very similar circumstances. So what we're looking at here is the entire T2 class works.
But is it really relevant to this particular situation as to whether or not the city council has rezoned other areas from B1 to T2?
To me, it shows that the T2 zoning is rational and that it furthers residential feel and development, and that it's irrational to state that T2 zoning, which has a very clear and obvious purpose to further residential development and residential feel, to say that that's a reason not to switch from B1 to T2 is irrational. And that's, I don't think that the city, I mean, if you look at the city council, I mean, those comments are buried within a host of other impermissible considerations, but.
Right, but all we need is one rational reason. You can have a dozen irrational reasons, but if there's one rational,
right, and
based on our standard review, that's all that's needed.
And I just think in context, when you look at it, that solitary comment about preserving a residential feel, it's irrational to say that T2 zoning doesn't accomplish that. And that's why I say you have to look at the entire zoning class and the decision.
There's a difference between irrational and disingenuous. And it sounds like you're arguing more for disingenuous.
Well, I think it's certainly disingenuous, but I also think it is irrational to say that a zoning classification, which is clearly motivated to preserve residential uses, and which all the evidence in the record leading up to the hearing was that T2 zoning was appropriate and did further the residential feel and did accomplish all those goals. This is the irony that I point out, and I have 16 seconds left with respect to the protective order and everything else. It's that everything leading up to the hearing was that T2 zoning was appropriate, and everything against the rezoning were impermissible purposes. And then at the hearing, the city just went against everyone in a rational way. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you both for your briefing and your oral arguments. Both of them were very well done, and we appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both.